Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Clayton Swisher, who's the Director of Programs at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. He's just back from the West Bank in Palestine, where he served as an election monitor with President Jimmy Carter, observing the recent elections in which Hamas was victorious, catching the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, by surprise. We'll also speak with Paul Craig Roberts, who's a former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration. He's an extremely vitriolic critic of the Bush administration, coming from a conservative perspective. He will do a critique on the Bush State of the Union. He's the author of The Tyranny of Good Intentions. We'll also speak with Elizabeth de la Vega, who's a former federal prosecutor with more than 20 years of experience. She'll be talking to us about what's happening in terms of the Fitzgerald investigation into the outing of the CIA officer Valerie Plame. Just this week, Scooter Libby's trial has been postponed till after the elections. Apparently, key emails from the White House concerning that trial are missing. And also, in the context of the brazen, almost mafia-like behavior of the Bush administration, they have removed or perhaps bribed the chief prosecutor in the Abramoff case in the Justice Department with a federal judgeship. Of course, they claimed there's no connection. Let's now begin with Clayton Swisher, who's just, as I mentioned, is Director of Programs at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., and the author of a new book, The Truth About Camp David. He just returned from the West Bank in Palestine, where he served as election monitor with President Jimmy Carter's delegation, observing the recent election in which Hamas was victorious. And I was just on the phone to the West Bank, Clayton, trying to track down spokespeople for Hamas, and it's pretty difficult, as you probably realize, to get anybody from Hamas on. And it turned out the people that we were trying to get are now in Cairo with a delegation of Hamas who apparently are touring the region to find alternative sources of revenue with the expectation that the United States and the Europeans will cut off funds. So let's begin with that. Do you think that in effect, by cutting off Hamas's funds, we're driving them into the hands of the Iranians?
Well, thanks for having me, and it's always a pleasure to be on the show. I think that's a correct assessment. What the United States should be looking at is channeling money to the right people within the Palestinian Authority and the right NGOs, and certainly we have the auditing mechanisms to do that. Let's put things in perspective here. We're not talking about a considerable sum of aid. It certainly falls short of the billions we give Israel each year, but nonetheless, $250 million. Does go to the Palestinians, and so I think maybe smarter allocations of the money might avert Hamas having to, seek outside external Iranian and Syrian aid.
You know, it's pretty extraordinary. I mentioned in the opening that the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, said that they had no idea and they were totally caught by surprise by the Hamas victory, as they were apparently by 9/11, even though Clark and others inside the White House had warned them about it. I had spoken a couple of weeks earlier to some people, Dr. Barghouti and also a former member of the Israeli Knesset, where we talked about some Hamas probably would win the election. So it wasn't exactly surprising because the Palestinians effectively had a choice between a feckless, corrupt regime and an organization that delivered services. It'd be like choosing between the mafia and the Salvation Army.
And let me just add a few points to that I think are even bigger than the corruption, which people totally ignore. A choice between an organization, the PLO, that recognizes Israel in 1988 without a concurrent recognition by the Israelis of Palestinians' right to exist within the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, a PLO that engaged in the Oslo peace process in 1993 and until 2006 was still unable to get the Americans and the Israelis to offer them a viable two-state solution, a PLO that supports Arafat and Abu Mazen, that promises sweeping reforms, doesn't produce them. So it's about the failure to deliver. I mean, President Bush during Abu Mazen's last visit here said, if a two-state solution doesn't happen on my watch, I'm not going to lose sleep over it. I'm not going for the history books. I mean, these types of signals play very negatively back home. And you have Condi Rice coming out to the region in November, and everyone showed up, you know, the media, to capture the border crossing agreement. But is anyone noticing now how that agreement was never implemented? Is anyone noticing how at the Kearney crossing, Palestinian goods are rotting by the tonnage of, you know, tomatoes and other goods, and that milk from Israel is not able to get into the Gaza Strip? And is it any wonder that people there are turning to Hamas, who's you know, they're rationing, they're distributing things as equitable as possible. They're trying to manage the occupation more effectively and in a disciplined way. So our actions here from Washington and our inactions are, as I wrote in the LA Times this summer after I got back from Gaza, are effectively handing the vote to Hamas. And they did hand the vote to Hamas. It's incredible that they claimed that they didn't see this coming.
Well, you know, I feel like quoting Clinton, you know, or Carville, you know, it's the occupation, stupid. I mean, here we are, the United States, in the occupation business in Iraq. It's getting close to 4 years, and it's a complete catastrophe. The Israelis have occupied that place for, I think, over 40 years, and they haven't. And it's really interesting to note that the independents, the people that we see often on television, like Barghouti and Hanan Ashwari and others, these are the homegrown people that we never nurtured, or the Israelis never nurtured. They now they're reaping the whirlwind of basically brutalizing these people and bottling them up, rather than giving them any autonomy. And now, I mean, it seems on the Israeli right, they're basically saying, "I told you so." So I'm beginning to wonder whether this is, you know, sort of been the deal all along. They've had this so-called peace process, but no peace.
Well, there's merit to that. I mean, the Israelis said with Arafat there was no partner for peace. As I write in my book, and I debunk the generous Camp David author myth, they said that there was no partner. And so for years, U.S. policy was, well, we just, you know, President Bush calls on the Palestinians to elect new leaders, and let's just wait until Arafat dies. Well, then the U.S. gets what they want. And Palestinians go to the polls, and they elect the closest thing to a Palestinian mother, Teresa, Abu Mazen. And yet the Israelis still say there's no partner, that he's too weak, that he's too this, too that. They continue to work unilaterally. They disengage from Gaza without any consultations whatsoever. Hamas claims it as a victory. It looks like a victory. Violence works. Negotiations doesn't. And then Abu Mazen is undermined, and here we are. We say now Hamas is in charge. There's still no partner, which gives license to the Israelis to effectively continue building the wall, creating a border, de facto border, that they decide that they want. One that snakes through the West Bank, annexes settlements, cuts through farmland, and makes a viable two-state solution impossible. So it certainly serves the Likud party's interest in Israel to not have someone credible.
But also, you know, Clayton, you have to admit that much of what Hamas says is a sort of mirror image of what Likud have been saying since the days of Begin and Shamir. You know,
oh, they're ideological.
They're twins.
They complement each other nicely. That's, I mean, to get back to your earlier point though about the U.S. marginalizing the independents, there's no greater evidence of this. I mean, in the Middle East, the U.S. always wants autocrats. We want people who will shake hands over agreements that we deem are favorable to us in the short term, even though that they might not have a groundswell of popular grassroots support. And so what we end up getting is autocrats, and then over time the agreements become flimsier, they become fake, and people eventually revolt against them, and they come to resent the United States. So we had people at the Madrid conference, which preceded the Oslo process, like Dr. Haider Abdeshafi, Hanan Ashwari, very liberal intellectual Palestinians who refused to engage in negotiations with the Israelis until the Israelis recognized the Palestinians' right to exist along the 67 lines. And everyone's always calling on the Palestinians to respect that and acknowledge it. But they were saying, no, we want a recognition that they will respect our rights to live here, and much the same words we're hearing from Hamas these days. And so what they saw over the years, and they were ultimately proven right, was by the settlement construction in the West Bank and Gaza, which in East Jerusalem, which has proven that the Israelis don't intend to just have a state along the 67 lines. They want to keep expanding their borders. This all leads to resistance and violence and terror, unfortunately. And so it just seems like we're butting our heads against the wall, hoping that the Palestinians will renounce violence, which, you know, they believe they have a right to do, and this isn't just Hamas, this is Fatah. Every Palestinian believes they have a right to resist a belligerent military occupation, especially when there's home demolitions, land confiscations, etc. And so rather than, you know, addressing the source of these concerns and saying, you know, Israel must stop settlement expansion, they must recognize the Palestinians' right to exist, we're going to, again, throw our heads against the wall and say what the Palestinians must do, what Hamas must do. And I'm afraid it's not going to get us anywhere.
Well, there has always been in Israel, it's always seemed to be a political problem rather than a historical, geopolitical, you know, the old joke is, albeit a, you know, black humor, that there's too much history and not enough geography. But the long and the short of it is, there's always the people who've always called for, on the Israeli side, for a two-state solution are the military pragmatists, people coming out of military intelligence, Mossad, and the generals like Rabin, and even Sharon, towards before he was incapacitated, he seemed to have gone away from the evangelical, God gave us the land, the Likudnik mindset, to the more pragmatic mindset. So is there any life left in that? Because it seems to me that with the election of Hamas, it's not wouldn't surprise me that the Israelis then react to the right and elect Netanyahu.
I don't think they're going to go that way. I think Olmert is enjoying a lot of popularity right now because Kadima, the party that Sharon started before his incapacitation, was about bringing the left, the center, and the right together under a common theme of let's disengage from the Arabs. There's no partner. That has a very wide consensus in Israel. And while I think Sharon probably had in mind removing a couple inconsequential settlements from the West Bank over the next 2 years, I mean, let's talk about the time that Sharon announced his Gaza disengagement before execution of it. It was 2 years. In 2 years, you know, Sharon might have gotten out of, 11 or 12 inconsequential West Bank settlements. It would have, he would have said it's time to prepare. The Bush administration would have allowed him to do that. Meanwhile, he would have built more facts on the ground, continue building the wall, sealing off East Jerusalem, and then getting over credit from once the actual disengagement took place. Whereas I think Ehud Olmert is probably a little bit more pragmatic, probably has, in his mind, bigger concessions. But all of this will require negotiations at some point because the two are inextricably linked. It's not just a matter of geography, it's a proximity problem. You know, the Palestinians rely on the Israelis to turn the lights on, to for sewage, for water. I mean, there's all sorts of ways that these two groups are interconnected. So it's
that's the bottom line here. So there are two paths. There's the unilateral path of just powerful dictates, because after all, the Israelis are the ones with the power. And there's the negotiation path, and that seems to be the dilemma we have now. Which one they'll choose. Now it's true that Olmert just tore down one of these settlements, but you can see from the pictures that it's not easy for any Israeli politician to pull down these settlements. I mean, when they get to the really big ones and get to those nutcases inside of Hebron.
I was just in Hebron, and Ian, you couldn't have said it more appropriately. Nutcases, that's what it is. I mean, I walked through the old city where the Palestinians have tarps above their stores to prevent the settler squatters that are squatting above their businesses from throwing buckets of urine down on them. I took photos with my own camera where they spray painted on Palestinian shops, death to the Arabs or gas to the Arabs. I mean, this is, and you know what, and when they hurl their insults in it, you know that the insults, you can detect a very distinct Brooklyn or American accent. I mean, this is something that we have encouraged, over the years, and we've looked the other way on it, and
Well, I'm not sure that we've encouraged. I think most U.S. presidents have stuck to it. I mean,
more settlements were built under Clinton and Bush, Bush Jr. than in the history since 1967. I mean, that's a fact. I mean, we've walked away from our staunch opposition to settlements because we believed, for a variety of reasons, that the Israelis were going to throw the big Hail Mary and resolve it. So what difference does it make if they're going to tear them down? This is a way of releasing the pressure valve for the radical right while we move to a big peace agreement. So, but the problem was no big peace agreement ever came, and so these facts on the ground only got more concrete. And now, I mean, one can hope that the images of these settlers attacking soldiers and policemen, as we saw in Amona, This is playing very negatively in the Israeli press, and we can only hope that the public will start to sit up and say, hey, wait a second, whose side are these guys on? They're attacking our sons and daughters. And also, it's a tremendous burden on Israeli society. I mean, they have a mandatory conscription draft in Israel, and every you know 18-year-old Israeli has to go and serve. And so they're oftentimes they're there on protective details to bodyguard the settlers and look after their homes and their outposts. So it's a tremendous drain and burden.
Well, you know, they're prior to Sharon's incapacitation, there were at least 200 active investigations on the part of Shin Bet into assassination plans to kill him. And we know that Rabin was killed by a right-wing guy. I think his brother was involved in an attempt on or a threat against Sharon. So this has got to make the Israeli people think. But on the long and the short of it is, the on the Palestinian side now that they have Hamas, who is, as we mentioned, a kind of a mirror image of Likud in terms of being rigid and rejectionist. You know, they're basically their attitude is we're not leaving and we're going to breed you out. On the Israeli side, I don't know what they think anymore. What I mean,
they think they're going to build a wall,
right,
and just keep them out. So right. I mean, you have unilateralism in both societies. I was sat down before I left the region with an Israeli journalist, Akiva Eldar from Haaretz. And Akiva aptly put it that this is unilateralism by both sides. Unilateralism by the Israelis saying that there's no partner, and the Palestinians saying there's no partner on the other side either, so we vote Hamas, someone who at least will be, as one other Palestinian put it to me, a less corrupt jail representative. This is some Palestinians compare this to who's going to negotiate with a guard. Well, one guy's taking too many cigarettes in exchange for favorites. For favors, and so they see Hamas is dealing with the jailer in a more honest, disciplined, transparent way, and not screwing his colleagues or their colleagues. So,
well, maybe there's in the end of the day, this is at least instead of this phony, dragged out, endless peace process that's a process rather than about peace. Maybe there's some clarity to this mutual rejectionism. If they do put the wall down totally, that means that the people on the wrong side of the wall, the settlers, are going to have to move, doesn't it?
Well, it would, but I don't think that they would just move. I mean, these are the kinds that would hold themselves up and attempt a Waco. And I mean, they also...
Right. Well, what about on the Palestinian side, though? How are they going to be a viable state if they reject, if they say, to hell with Israel? How did the West Bank and Gaza are not connected? They have to go through Israel. So
that's true. I mean, they have to make a compromise. But here's the thing. We cannot make the mistake of calling on Hamas. There's a lot of things we want Hamas to change. For example, their use of terrorism. Mm-hmm. Okay, we all agree that terrorism should not be used against Israelis. Inside Israel, the 67 borders, that it's reprehensible, that it's no responsible government or aspiring government can do this. But when we talk about violence, it's an unspoken thing in Washington, but I think Washington treats it very differently. If they were attacking only settlers and soldiers in the West Bank who are doing home demolitions and settlement expansion, the international community would treat it differently because there's a right to resist occupation under international law. So we can't be too sweeping in what we demand of the Palestinians of Hamas. Just like the same thing with Hamas recognizing Israel along the 67 lines. I mean, we don't say along the 67 lines. We don't say they have to recognize Israel's right to exist and the Palestinians' right to exist in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. So if you're going to ask Hamas to say that they recognize Israel everywhere there's a Jewish settlement, you might as well wait for Hamas to sing Haktiva and hold your breath and turn blue in the face, because it's just not going to happen.
Well, Clayton Swisher, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles and for your insight, having just returned from the West Bank in Palestine, where you were an election monitor with President Jimmy Carter, observing this Hamas victory.
Ian, if I could just add that for your listeners there on the West Coast, if they don't think their voices matter, they do. And if they think that the administration should do more, they should let them know. Someone who looks at this region, I have to say, and just coming back from there, there's no doubt in my mind that Homeland Security starts there. And, you know, if we want to be safe here in this country, we have to adjust our policies there and approach things more equitably and sanely. So, you know, I'm glad you're having this discussion. It's an important debate. I just hope people will do something with it.
I thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Ian.
Bye-bye. I was just speaking then with Clayton Swisher, who's the director of the programs for Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., and the author of a new book, The Truth About Camp David. He's just returned from the West Bank in Palestine, where he served as an election monitor with President Jimmy Carter. I'm now speaking with Paul Craig Roberts, who's an assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration. He was the associate editor of the Wall Street Journal editorial page and a contributing editor to the National Review. He's the co-author of The Tyranny of Good Intentions. And I wanted to talk to you about, Paul Craig Roberts, about the president's State of the Union, since you wrote a blistering critique of the president's State of the Union. If I may, let me just read you the first paragraph you wrote. The State of the Union is disastrous. By its naked aggression, bullying, illegal spying on Americans, and illegal torture and detentions, the Bush administration has demonstrated American contempt for the Geneva Conventions, for human life and dignity, and for the civil liberties of its own citizens. Increasingly, the United States is isolated in the world, having to resort to bribery and threats to impose its dictates. No country any longer looks to America for moral leadership. The U.S. has become a rogue nation. Strong words.
I don't think there's anything unexceptional about that. It's just the standard view throughout the world, and I don't see this even debatable.
Well, why then is it a minority opinion? Because, I mean, I agree with you.
A minority opinion where?
In the United States. I mean,
the United States is different. They think that they are under attack by Muslims and that everything goes, anything can be done. They're full of disinformation and fear.
The United States of fear?
Oh, yeah, sure. They seem to be scared to death. Now we're going to attack yet another country in the Middle East based on wild assertions and assumptions and fear.
Well, it is interesting to contrast. In one of the darkest hours in American history, President Roosevelt said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." Contrast that with President Bush's State of the Union the other night, where he again said, "We got to take bin Laden's threat seriously. He's out to get us." So, in effect, what the president is saying is that we have this war on terror. The whole country is at war, as it was in World War I and II. Oh, yeah. In this case, the superpower is up against a cave dweller. I don't get the symmetry here. I don't know why we call it a war. I mean, to me, it's, you know...
Well, they have some other agenda, and they're not telling us what it is. And they're pretending it's weapons of mass destruction, or that somehow the United States is threatened by Iraq. I mean, it's hilarious that people fall for this. Or that the United States is threatened by Iran, or that the United States has to protect Israel from Iran. Why does the United States have to protect Israel from Iran? It's well known Israel has 200 nuclear weapons. Iran has none. I mean, Iran can't attack Israel.
Well, their leader did say they want
to... Iraq can attack the United States. The whole thing is an absurdity. They have some agenda. They don't describe what their agenda is. They tell us a bunch of lies, and they whip up fear and disinformation. It takes an inattentive and irresponsible population to fall for that.
Well, tell me what you think their real agenda is then, Paul Craig Roberts.
I don't know what it is. I think probably it's a confluence of many groups' agendas. I think the neoconservative agenda is Israeli hegemony in the Middle East. I think that's what's the most powerful motivation. I think Karl Rove's motivation is to wrap the president in the flag and make him a war president so that he can survive. I think the motivation of the police bureaucracies is to get more unaccountable power.
You mean Homeland
Security? Motivation
of
the defense industries, what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, is more profits. You know, the security firms want more customers. I mean, there's all sort of motivations at work that make it acceptable.
So, in other words, paranoia works for some.
Well, that's what Goebbels said. You know, he said that our whole success is based on telling the German people a bunch of lies and getting them all worked up with fear. So I think it always works.
Well, Paul Craig Roberts, you were the Assistant Secretary of Treasury under President Reagan, and in your article that we're referring to, your critique of the President's State of the Union, you mention that at Davos this year, Stephen Roach of Merrill Lynch, who I've interviewed a couple of times in the past, he was at Davos, and he's just in terms of what the Bush administration is doing to the American economy, which is clearly stressed. Tell me why you think that Roche's change of heart is significant here, since he's a free trader.
I'll be glad to. You know, and keep in mind that my criticism of the State of the Union message is entirely economics, except for the first paragraph that you
read.
Right,
yeah, that's why I wanted to segue.
Including paragraph.
Yeah.
The whole bulk of my column is about the disastrous state of the economy. Now, Steve Roach at Morgan Stanley has been a cheerleader for globalization, that is, for outsourcing offshore production for American markets. And the meetings at Davos have always been sort of the launching pad and the cheerleading squad for outsourcing and globalization. And the line that they had, what they professed to have believed, is that this was win-win for everybody. The first world, the United States, for example, would receive much cheaper manufactured goods. And the third world, China, for example, would receive much better jobs and some beginning form of economic development. And the first world was to make up for the lost manufacturing jobs with new knowledge jobs. And what Roach said on his return recently from the last Davos meeting is that, hey, the win for the United States is not showing up. And the reason it's not is that the outsourcing has proceeded so rapidly from call center type jobs to engineering jobs, even the medical profession, stock analysts, accounting. In other words, we're losing all of the high-end knowledge jobs to outsourcing just as rapidly, if not more rapidly, than we lost manufacturing. So there's no sign of any win for the first world. And that was what I have said from the beginning. It was obvious from the beginning there would be no win. But now we see a break in the ranks, and we see that the cheerleaders at the annual meeting every year in Switzerland for globalization now realize that it's not working out like they thought.
But this is wiping out the American middle class. The bottom
very rapidly,
line,
it's wiping them out very rapidly. Every month, when the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Labor Department release the payroll jobs data, I take the data, I look at it, and I analyze it. And what I found every month for years is that the only is, first of all, very few net jobs are created anymore by the United States economy. We're exactly, in the last 7 years, we are missing 7 million jobs that are required just to keep up with the growth of population. Now, that fact is a fact. The next important fact is that the jobs that are created, the few jobs that are created, are concentrated in waitresses and bartenders, construction, which goes mainly to Mexicans, both legal and illegal, and health care and social assistance, things like hospital orderlies and that sort of thing.
And they're bringing in people from the Philippines for that, too. So.
And now they're bringing in people for everything. If they can't outsource it over the Internet, they bring them in on H-1B work visas, L-1 work visas. They claim there are always shortages. There's a shortage of everything. There's a shortage of engineers, and we have several hundred thousand unemployed American engineers. the engineers are being laid off in mass, and they still say, oh, there's a shortage. We need more Indian engineers.
With Paul Craig Roberts, what you're talking about here, to me, cries out for a new political movement in this country. It seems to me it's time for the American people to wake up, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, and to wake up to the fundamental thing that the American capitalists no longer have any obligation to be patriotic and American. They can move their factory, close a factory down in Massachusetts and move it to Singapore in a blink of an eye, and there's no sanction against them. What has happened since then is that the trend has accelerated with the arrival of George W. Bush, and that it's enough to make you a Marxist. The idea is that if you look at the way household income and capital have tracked, they've always been capital formation. They've always run in parallel. Now, since globalization, suddenly the capital is the only benefit for the new global economy, and household income's going down. So the graphs, the lines are diverging with capital being the only beneficiary of, and not labor, of the new globalism, and household income going down. So, I mean, as I say, it's
yes,
stuck.
American household income is going down. It's going up in China. We're basically redistributing American incomes from American families to Chinese families.
Yeah, but we're not in the charity business. There has to be a reason for this.
Oh, the reason for it is that they work for less.
And
the missing element in the equation, which nobody seems to comprehend, is that once the American workforce hasn't any more incomes, who's going to buy all the products?
Well, that was Henry Ford's adage, wasn't it?
That was his. That's exactly right.
But you got to pay your workers enough to build the product that you make.
That's right.
You to
see,
buy
what,
the product.
What globalization is doing, it's separating American incomes and jobs from the goods and services that they consume. And so since they don't have any incomes associated with the goods and services that they consume, they're not much longer going to be able to consume them. That's the situation. So it is headed for a massive catastrophe, but no one wants to to hear about it. They have all these ideologies about free trade and freedom, and people are free to do what they want. But
surely the middle class, who are becoming extinct, and that's basically, you know, from my image of America, particularly after World War II, was the American dream, wasn't it?
You see, what has always made the disparity in income in the United States acceptable has been the ladders of upward mobility. They were there, and people with enough smarts or energy or good luck could climb them. But when you dismantle them, then there's no longer a way to get from the bottom to the top. And then that makes it very polarized. And I think the political instability down the road will be rather high.
So do you think at some point or other that the middle class will wake up to its demise and start demanding that politicians represent them and not capital?
I don't know. As long as they can be kept mindlessly wrapped in the flag and fearful of terrorists and attacks, and who knows what they'll do. They seem to be so easy to fool, you don't know if they'll ever catch on. I just really, the people who are catching on, I think, are the parents of high school and college kids, because they all send me emails wanting to know what their children can possibly study, what skills can they possibly acquire that can't be outsourced.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main plea I get from people. And so those people at least are aware of it, because, you know, for several years now, the crop of university students, what is their mainstay? It's being a waitress or a waiter or a bartender.
But, you know, when you look at the economic trend and the way, and obviously who benefits from this, you know, President Bush effectively represents the inheritors and the investors. And to me, this smacks of a kind of neo-medievalism, where you end up with a society with a kind of super-rich aristocracy, a powerful theocracy, a church, and a military. And those are the three pillars of medievalism. I mean, is that where we're heading?
Well, we'd have to agree with you. The question is whether the people will accept it and serve in the military.
Well, I guess what's going on in Iraq is not exactly a good advertisement for joining the military. But again, it's so much worse in Iraq than the press reports or the public realizes. So I just don't know what it's going to take.
But you see, look, if you noticed last Friday evening on the PBS news program Now, we had former Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff. He was on the program, and he said that the speech, the Iraq speech that Powell was forced to give the UN was, quote, a hoax on the American people, on the international community, and on the United Nations Security Council. Now, Powell himself has declared the speech to be a blot on his career. So here we have, we are in a war that was a hoax. And yet, you still find, roughly, according to polls, half the population supports Bush, supports the war, and would support an invasion of Iran. So you have to wonder whether the people have enough wits to be aware of what is happening around them and how it's going to affect them.
Well, if you watched Fox News, Paul Craig Roberts, you'd be totally out of touch with reality.
And it's the Ministry of Propaganda, yeah.
So how did this happen in the land of the free and the home of the brave, where, you know, normally I used to spend a lot of time in the Soviet Union, and half the KGB guys you knew were working for TASS or Pravda, and you knew that you know anybody that was a journalist over there was either KGB or they had to promote the party line. But you understood that they were trapped in a system that forced you to promote the party line. The idea in a free country that journalists and media moguls would volunteer to become the information ministry of the government in power, the Pravda of the Bush regime, is just despicable.
Yes, but it's easy to understand, because think back to the 1990s when the massive media concentration was permitted, so that now most of the media is held by what, four or five corporate hands. So when you've got these huge media conglomerates, the value of which are their broadcast licenses, they can't afford to get on the wrong side of the government. They're not going to let the newspapers say anything. They're not going to let the TV say anything, because the value of the licenses is too great. Also, in corporate hands, the bottom line is the advertising revenues. They can't afford to be controversial, and so they purvey a bland, politically correct line. It's very easy to understand also because of 9/11. The interpretation of 9/11, that we were somehow attacked by this Muslim conspiracy and it's going to happen again any minute, blah, blah. No one wants to say or take a position that's critical of a country that's had another so-called Pearl Harbor. Keep in mind that it was the neoconservatives who wrote years in advance that what the country needed was another Pearl Harbor so that they could organize the military to deal with the situation in the Middle East.
Well, Paul Craig Roberts, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles.
Yes, thank you for sharing your audience with me.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. So just speaking there with Paul Craig Roberts, who was an assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration. He was the associate editor of the Wall Street Journal editorial page and a contributing editor of National Review. He's the co-author of The Tyranny of Good Intentions, and we were talking to he was giving a conservative, an angry conservative's view of the State of the Union. I'm speaking now with Elizabeth de la Vega, who is a former federal prosecutor with more than 20 years of experience. Her commentary and analysis appeared in The Nation magazine, Los Angeles Times, and Salon. And we're talking about what's happening in terms of the Fitzgerald inquiry and into the outing of Valerie Wilson. And just to begin with, Elizabeth de la Vega, it seems to me that you can almost, I find the activities of the Bush administration at times so brazen that they sort of make the mafia look like milquetoast. I mean, Hillman in the Justice Department, who's in charge of the Abramoff prosecution, suddenly he's offered a federal judgeship. Key emails are missing in terms of what Scooter Libby was up to, and in the Plame case. And now we have the trial being delayed to January after the elections, and the judge not being happy with it, but apparently the lawyer has a conflict. Are we expected to accept this on face value?
Which part? There are so many things. If you're asking me about the continuance of the trial,
yeah, I think we've got to come up with a better word than chutzpah.
Right. Well, it's unbelievable what this administration does, and for some reason, by being so brazen, they have this ability to cow people into not identifying what they're doing. And I think there's a strange phenomenon that occurs, which is that when people do absolutely outrageous things, the people who call them on it and describe those outrageous things are fearful of seeming outrageous themselves, because it sounds so far-fetched. But I think that you're completely accurate. The Bush administration seems to have no qualms about doing absolutely anything they have to do in order to achieve the goals that they want.
And do you think they'll get away with it?
Well, in the case of the Plame leak, I think that I can't say what would happen if they are charged, you know, in terms of a pardon or whatever, but I really do believe that Karl Rove is going to be charged as well, along with Louis Libby, who's already been charged. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if other people were charged as well, because the evidence against Karl Rove is so overwhelming that and Patrick Fitzgerald to me seems like somebody who is completely immune to the political process one way or the other. I think he's just committed to doing what he thinks is right.
So why hasn't he pulled the trigger?
Well, having been in his shoes before, not in a case of this sort, but there are a lot of things that take a long time that people don't really realize. For example, in the Plame leak case, he did the indictment of Louis Libby, but now there's a new grand jury. So in order to get them up to speed, the law requires that you have to represent the whole case. You can't just take it from there as if they already knew what was going on. So that's time-consuming. And as we know, he's in charge of the office in Chicago, so he has all kinds of other cases going on as well. And grand juries don't meet every day. Most often they meet once a week. So there are a lot of things that go on behind the scenes that we don't know about. And it seems like a long time to us, but it's really not in the context of preparing an indictment.
Well, what we've learned from Judge Tatel, and I guess from Libby's lawyer just in the last few days, is that apparently the first person to tell Scooter Libby about Valerie Wilson, the wife of the ambassador, who was sent by the CIA at the behest of Dick Cheney to look into this this bogus Niger idea that Saddam was trying to buy yellow cake from Niger, based upon forged documents, by the way. So it turns out that, I don't know whether Libby's turning on his patron, the vice president, but he says that it was Cheney who first told him. And, of course, he's in trouble because he lied to Fitzgerald by saying, I first heard of it from these reporters. And that's what's her name, Judith Miller, was covering up for him. And why they, finally, that's why it was key that he crack her, you know.
Well, actually, in the indictment that came out in October, it's very clear that someone had already testified about the fact that Libby had learned about the Valerie Plame's existence and that she was the wife of Joseph Wilson from the vice president, because that's an allegation in the indictment. And Libby's defense and statements in the grand jury apparently were, well, yes, the vice president told me about that, but I completely forgot. And so that when Tim Russert allegedly told him, although that doesn't seem to be the case either, he learned it as if it were brand new. That's what.
So this is all news then?
Well, it is, actually.
Okay.
But it comes out sounding like new news. But yes, it was in the indictment.
And there's nothing to be taken. There's no rift between Cheney and Libby then?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't say that. But what I would glean from what's going on is that somehow or other, in the investigation, Fitzgerald learned about this conversation between Libby and Cheney, and I believe it was because Libby takes notes every day of what he does. So they had Libby's notes, so he couldn't deny that he talked to Cheney about it. And the word, I think, plame is mentioned in there, in the notes. So he was stuck with that one, and he had to admit that one, but Libby didn't realize that the investigation had also shown that at least five other people from the administration had talked to him as well.
Let me remind the audience again, if I may. I'm speaking with Elizabeth de la Vega, who's a former federal prosecutor with more than 20 years of experience, and we're talking about the status of the Libby trial, the expectation, at least on Elizabeth's part, that Karl Rove will be indicted, and the fact that the trial has been put off till after the elections, and key emails are apparently missing from the White House. I always thought, Elizabeth, that the only thing that made any sense to understand why an experienced lawyer like Libby would have deliberately perjured himself was that Libby knew that he was effectively falling on his sword for the administration, knowing that he had to delay, or they had to delay Fitzgerald, and as Fitzgerald said in his press conference, throw sand in his face, in the umpire's face, so he didn't know where to look, that they were doing that, because had they not done that, Fitzgerald would have found all this stuff out much sooner, and then they would have had an embarrassing revelations before the last election. So do you have any explanation for why an experienced lawyer like Libby would deliberately perjure himself?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. First of all, it's not at all uncommon for experienced people of any from any line of work to perjure themselves, and probably the first reason is because they think that they will avoid getting in trouble themselves. And I think that no matter how experienced people are, and in fact sometimes the more experienced they are, they think they can talk themselves out of things, and they have a very high regard for their ability to control what's going on, and they don't really count on the fact that people are going to stick with it and stick, you know, with the investigation, because usually, say, in the political world, things kind of blow past them, and they can say whatever they want, and it's too late to do anything about it. So that's the first reason. The second reason is I think that Libby was definitely trying to protect Cheney and the whole group of them, who clearly were going after Joseph Wilson for reasons that have no legitimate purpose. The only purpose appeared to be absolutely political and vindictive. And I think the third reason, they definitely were trying to delay, and they didn't think that the reporters would end up having to testify. I think that is a key part of this. And Bush even gave that away, I think it was October 7th of 2003. He said, I don't think we're ever going to find this leaker. You reporters are notorious for keeping your own counsel and not giving away your sources.
Right, and he said this. He said there are thousands of senior officials, and
right.
he was made very light of the whole thing.
He did.
Well, you know, I believe, and I've done some investigation into this, and some time back in April, I was interviewing a former head of counterterrorism at the CIA, Vince Canestrero, and he said that, you know, because the whole thing that the press has not followed very adequately, I think, is the provenance of the very documents that were the basis of the Niger's inquiry on the part of Wilson, which which we know were forged. And so the question that seems to me sort of raising its head there like a 900-pound gorilla is, who forged them? And Canestrero said that, contrary to what we had normally heard, that they came out of Italian intelligence, that they were created over here in the United States, and He didn't want to say who it was, so I offered the name Michael Ledeen, a neocon who's got connections to Italian intelligence, and close with both. He was the first consultant to the Office of Special Plans at the Pentagon under Doug Feith, and also very close to Dick Cheney, one of his inner circle. any rate, Lalinde said, threatened to sue, and I had to post his protestations on my website. And other people have been sniffing around, and apparently there was an investigation done, and there's this phase two investigation that Senator Pat Roberts was trying to avoid, and the Democrats shut down the Senate in order to put some pressure on them to resume it. So we don't really know where it stands now, but there's certainly a lot of suspicion that these documents actually were tasked by the neoconservatives working for Vice President. And at the end of the day, it's quite possible that the Vice President, who couldn't find the intelligence he wanted, tasked this phony intelligence so that they could feed it to Townsend and feed it back to themselves. And if this is the case, then it kind of explains the outing of Valerie Plame in a different light, that it's something far more important on their minds than just punishing
I think that the outing of Valerie Plame, like virtually any kind of crime, has, as I said before, has a lot of explanations, and it's kind of like the Russian dolls, where there's one inside of another. And I don't think it's really possible to pinpoint only one, but I think you've touched on something that's really important, which is that at the time of Joseph Wilson's article, first of all, the administration actually admitted that the allegation about attempts to find yellow cake uranium in Niger by Iraq was not true. But yet, they didn't want the focus to be on that, because that was really the last piece of evidence that they had that would tie Iraq to anything having to do with nuclear weapons.
And this is when they were coming up with a dry hole in Iraq.
Right, right.
After the invasion, right.
And so the pressure was really increasing, and then you have this person who comes out and says, well, not only is this allegation not true, but I have information that shows that they knew it wasn't true. Mm. So,
by the way, there's new information emerging that President Bush may well have learned about Wilson's trips and his findings in his PDF, his presidential daily briefing.
Right, well, which doesn't surprise me at all, because it's very clear from just the level of activity. And first of all, we know in a general sense what this administration does when they focus on somebody or something. They have a full-fledged attack. And we know that there were calls made to all kinds of different reporters that week after the article came out. Condoleezza Rice was on news shows, and there are all these press conferences and so forth. So for Libby to suggest now that this was something that was not on his front burner is absolutely absurd, because even from what we know publicly, it's clear that they were completely focused on this, and they had to be, because the press kept asking them about it. Mm. So,
but do you think there's a Brer Rabbit kind of component to this, you know, where they're doing a kind of three-card Monty, trying to distract us from where they're really vulnerable?
Well, I think it's all of, you know, I think it's all connected. And I do think the last thing they wanted was to get to the point where there was evidence that showed they knew the allegations were false. And I do think that there are a lot of suspicious aspects of the appearance of these documents. I mean,
well, that's the thing. Why would you forge documents? Who would want to forge documents? Who would benefit from this phony intelligence?
Right.
And it's the same phony intelligence that the White House, particularly Cheney, has been trying to sell.
Right. Well, apparently these documents actually existed before October 2002 is when the president made a speech to the nation about why we had to go to war in Iraq. And right before that was a back and forth between the administration and the CIA about this very issue, about the Iraq uranium allegation with Niger. And the CIA said, even the CIA said, no, you can't put it in there. So he gave a speech without it. And as I understand it, it was the very next day. It was October 7th, and Bush gave a speech October 6th, 2002. The very next day, those documents appeared in the hands of this Italian journalist. Mm-hmm. So when you put things together in a timeline, as you've obviously done as well, it's extremely suspicious. And you're right, there's nobody else who would have a reason to do it.
And the break-in at the Niger embassy took place the day after Bush's inauguration.
Oh, it did?
Yeah. So it's like these guys were waiting around for 8 years, suffering under Clinton, to finally remake the world.
And the other thing about Michael Ledeen, as you obviously know because you've looked into him, is that in the summer of 2002, he was writing, and he probably still is, on National Review Online, absolutely inflammatory and outrageous things about why it would be good for the United States to turn the Middle East into a cauldron.
He was also
look at that, they can look at it.
Right. He was also writing for Panorama, the magazine that where these phony Niger forged documents were first tried to be sold.
Right, right.
So, well, I thank you very much for joining us, Elizabeth de la Vega, and we should stay in touch because I'm glad to hear that you think that Rove is still in the crosshairs, because I think that most people think he's dodged that bullet.
No, I don't think so. I think people don't really realize how long these things take, and there's really no sinister reason for that, I don't think. It just takes a long time.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Elizabeth de la Vega, a former federal prosecutor with more than 20 years of experience. And we're talking about the status of the investigation into the outing of the CIA officer Valerie Wilson, which has led to a special prosecution where Dick Cheney's right-hand man, his chief of staff, Scooter Libby, has been indicted, but now his trial won't take place until after the election. Key emails are missing from the White House. And as I mentioned earlier, the chief prosecutor in the Abrams case has been given a federal judgeship by the White House to get him out of there. At least that's what it appears to be. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the assistant producer, Carol Coote, the associate producer.